Okay, so again, we spent a lot of time talking about what the structure of our event space should be. And again, the goal is to have something to which one can sensibly assign probabilities. Okay. So our third component of our probability space is the probability measure, which is going to assign probabilities to elements of our event space. And again, it's not going to do that in a completely random fashion. Again, we want to make sure that they obey the, at the very least, our instincts about probabilities. So our probability measure is going to obey the axioms of probability. Okay. And so the first axiom is that the probabilities, they're assigned between 0 and 1. And so, obviously, all probabilities are going to be greater than or equal to 0. And the probability of the entire event, something happening within the entire event space, is going to be 1. Or I should say, within the entire range of outcomes, not the event space. Okay, so again, let's just say that our outcomes cover all possibilities. Okay. Now, if we take disjoint events, so events whose intersection is 0, then the union, the probability of the union of those events is the sum of the probability of each individual event. So again, if you think of the probability of heads and probability of tails, their union is everything, and I expect the individual sums to add up to 1 or everything. And again, if we do that not just for some finite number, but a countably infinite number of disjoint events, then we get the same thing, that the probability assigned to their union has got to be the sum of the probability assigned to each individual piece. So, again, basic properties are going to fall out of this, and they're again related to this idea of the set nature and the construction of our event space. Okay, so the first one falls out from axiom 2 and 3, it just says the probability of an event's complement is 1 minus the probability of the event. That makes sense. Okay, so the event plus its complement, again, covers the whole space and in a disjoint fashion. Therefore, all probabilities are less than 1. Again, that's going to fall out from 2 and 3. The probability of the null event is 0. Well, that falls out from axiom 2. If the probability of everything is 1, well, axiom 2 plus property A. And then, finally, if you have events that are not disjoint, then you can still break them up into sort of disjoint components. Okay. So, again, with that... Sorry?
What is the difference between disjoint and independent?
We'll actually see a couple examples of disjoint versus independent. Disjoint is a set notion. It's a notion of sets, so it just means that there's no intersection between the two sets. And it's a different concept from independent, and if we wait a slide or two, we're going to see an example.
Sorry. Could you explain what C represents there? Concurrent, the concept.
C is the complement.
No, the item. C, yeah.
So that's the null set, so nothing in it.
Yeah.
And
probability of nothing is zero.
So the probability of nothing happening is zero, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So if you think of the probability of something happening, which is up here is one, then it's the reverse of that. Nothing happens, that's zero. Okay. So, again, this is just, it's a fairly logical, sort of sensible way to sort of define probabilities. And it will, again, allow the assignment of probabilities to an entire event set in a consistent way, in a way that you... it has a consistent interpretation. So there's a number of probability definitions that sort of go up beyond this basic assignment, but are still, again, quite useful to have and to reason about. The first of these is the idea of conditional probability. And so the idea here is that we may either know or have observed something about our probability space. And that allows us to reason further about events. Okay. So, as a definition, the probability of A given B is the probability of A intersect B divided by the probability of B. And we have to assume that the probability of B is non-zero, or else that doesn't make sense. Okay. So that means that if we know that B happened, it might give us some information about the likelihood of A. So we go back to our basic example. We have two dice, and... we have two events. The first one is, the first event is that the sum of the two dice is greater than 6. And the second one is that we see one of the dice. So we see that one of the numbers is 4. So the question then becomes... what's the like, if we've observed that die 1 is a 4, what's the likelihood that die 2 is, or that the sum together is greater than 6? Okay. So, if we look at these events, we see that The event B, again, limits us to 6 options. And then some of these intersect with event A. Okay. Now, if we just go by our definition, the probability of A intersect B is 4 out of the 36 possible outcomes. So assuming that everything's equally likely, it's 4 out of 36. The probability of B by itself is 6 of the possible 36 outcomes. So 6 over 36. Okay. So if we take those together, just plug them into our definition, then we get that the probability of A given B is 4 over 36 divided by 6 over 36 is 4 over 6, or 2/3. Another way of looking at it is that we've restricted our possible set of outcomes from the 36 to the 6 possible ones that the 6 possible outcomes where die 1 is 4. So the 6 possible outcomes in B. Again, if we look initially, each of those has a probability of 1 over 36. So each of the possible outcomes in that restricted set has a probability of 1 over 36. But we can think of this as being sort of a new probability space, a new set of events, where we, again, restrict the events to only the ones contained in B. Okay. The problem with that is that then if you sum up the initially assigned probabilities, then all you're getting is 6 over 36 is 1/6. So essentially what you need to do is you need to normalize the probability assignment. So you're going to restrict yourself to looking at each of these events, and the probability of each of them is going to be divided by the overall probability of B, which is 1/6. So you can think of it as assigning a new probability to each of these, which is 1/6, and then 4 of those, or A intersects with 4 of those, so you get 4/6. So, it's a couple of different ways of looking at it. But again, the basic idea is that if you are able to at least partially observe your outcomes, then you can sometimes infer what's going on, or more accurately infer what's going on. Okay. So that works because there's some sort of dependence between A and B. What you think instinctively is, well, 4 is a relatively large number for dice, and so you're more likely to have made up your sum with having rolled a 4 than you would be to have if you rolled a 1 as your first, or if you could observe a 1. Okay. Same thing applies in, say, poker. You can observe some of the cards on the board, and you then recalculate the odds of any given hand occurring based on what you can see. Okay. So that depends on there being some dependence between the two events. The flip side of that is that the events are independent. And if the events are independent, or the events, as a definition, the events are independent, if and only if the probability of their intersection is the probability of A times the probability of B. Okay. So, we can think of an experiment of tossing two independent coins, the probability of getting heads on one coin and heads on the second coin. So if the sequential is your probability of getting heads on the first coin is a half, your probability of getting heads on the second coin is also a half. And again, you can think of so that gives you one quarter, which, if you think about all possible outcomes of those two coin tosses, you have four of them. So again, one out of those four, you'd get a quarter. Okay. We can relate that back to our idea of conditional probability. So the probability of A, if A and B are independent, then the probability of A given B is just the probability of A. The probability of B given A is just the probability of B. So if they're independent, knowing something about the one doesn't give you any knowledge about the other. Okay, so again, there was a question about disjoint versus independent. And so here's two examples that illustrate the difference. So in the first one, we're rolling a single die. We have two events, the outcome is even or the outcome is odd. So it's one over the other, or the other. There's no intersection between those, so they're disjoint. But they're not independent. If you know that you had a head, if you observe a head, then you know you couldn't possibly have had a tail. So they're not independent. Now, second example, we roll two dice now. We can define different events. We define an event die 1 is even, and we define a second event die 2 is odd. So if we just sort of map out those events, when we say die 2 is odd, so that's die 2 has to be 1, 3, 5. Die 1 then is 2, 4, or 6. And what we see is that they aren't disjoint. So there is intersection. Then essentially that means that you can have times when die 1 is even and die 2 is odd. But knowing that die 1 is even doesn't tell you anything about the value for die 2. Therefore, again, they're independent. Okay, so one final sort of basic result that can come in handy, and so it sort of falls out from the results we've observed so far, is what's called the law of total partition. And so what we do here is that we assume that we divide up our sample space into a number of disjoint events, so into a number of non-overlapping events. Okay. So the law of total probability says that we can essentially, if we want to find the probability of any given event, we can divide it up according to our disjoint partition. And just as essentially, if we sum up all the probabilities of B, our disjoint partition, then we're going to get the whole space. If we take the intersection with A and add up each little piece of that, then again, we're going to get the whole of A. And that can be related then to your conditional probabilities. So the probability of A is the probability of A given these B's times what's the likelihood of the B's happening. Okay. So, again, that's the rules that the probability measure has to follow. Now, again, we'd like to start associating that probability measure with something more concrete within our event space. So we're going to start with a nice well-defined space, so it's going to be countable, so something like either the real or the natural numbers. Think of the natural numbers, something that you can index, and then we can take the power set of that. Now, what probability says, or what the probability measure does, is it's supposed to assign a value to each individual set. So again, it's going to get pretty tedious to start writing all of that down. Okay. So, what we're going to say is, well, if we have a countable number of points in our outcome space, then we can actually assign values to those points that act as probabilities. Okay. We call that function, which is assigning a value, again, to points, which we said we can't always do, but in this case, since we can count the number of points, we can do. We call that function a probability mass function. And so, as it's a function, it's potentially easier to write down. Okay, or as it's a function on points or numbers, that's potentially easier to write down. Okay. So that assignment has to obey all the rules for the probability measure. In particular, for all assignments, it's got to be greater than or equal to zero. And the sum over all possible points of your assignments has to equal one. You're essentially, if these points define a disjoint cover for your total space, outcome space, so they better, the probability is better, sum to one. Okay. Once we've assigned this probability mass to every single point, then we can assign probability to any event, so any set, by just totaling up the probability assigned to any point within the set. Okay. So, just a few examples of this. We have the binary PMF, probability mass function, and this is your coin flipping trial. We're now going to call heads and tails 0 and 1. And we assign a probability to 0 and a probability to 1. If you have a finite set of numbers and you want to say that they're equally likely or uniformly distributed, then we can assign a probability of, if there are n numbers, then 1 over n, it means that each of them is equally likely. So that's our roll of the die. Okay, then we have a binomial distribution. And we can think of this as trying to decide what the probability of having a certain number of successes in n independent coin flipping trials or Bernoulli trials. Okay. And so if you you can think of, probably rolling a die and how many times will 4 occur. So the probability 4 occurs is 1/6. The probability that 4 doesn't occur is 5/6. Then you do that 10 times. And again, your row, your probability is of success then is 1/6. And you're doing it n times. And choosing out of that, choosing out all possible ways that could occur. Sorry, I should say that you're choosing all possible ways that k, that could happen at k times within n. Okay, so again, the main point is just that you have numbers, possibly even in, you have numbers and then you can assign the probability to each of those numbers. Okay, you can do a similar thing over, so those examples, you had a finite space, you can do the same thing over any countably infinite space. Again, the main thing is you just have to have the sum of the probabilities is going to have to sum to one, so you have to have something that, for which that works. And so an example of this is either the geometric or the Poisson probability mass function. Okay. And so the geometric arises from, you have your Bernoulli trial and you stop when the first success occurs, okay? And the Poisson is, essentially a continuous version of that. Okay, so again, the main problem or the main requirement that you have to satisfy when assigning this mass function is that you're going to sum to 1. And again, this is for the geometric. So for the geometric function, you can use sort of some basic results about sums to do this. And the result we use is that the sum from 1 to infinity of x to the k is x over 1 minus x, and it should be, well, x between 0 and 1, not equal to 1. Okay, so if we look at our sum here, we can pull out the row, we can pull out the 1 minus row, and then just plug in the 1 minus row we have left for for our sum, and we again see that it worked. It does come out to 1, and it's okay. So, again, the next, as I said, if you define your PMF, then we should be able to define the probability of any event by just summing up the probabilities of individual points within that, individual elements within that event. So if your event is that you have success on 1, 2, 3, or 4, well, first, second, third, or fourth toss, then the success of before or at or before 4 is just adding up the success for 1 to 4. Okay. And, let's not get overly concerned with what the actual value is. Okay. So, we can appreciate that's a fairly handy concept, but it's only going to apply to discrete sample spaces, so these uncountable sample spaces we are not going to be able to apply. We can't, again, assign a probability to every point within that space. Okay. What we can do is define a what's called a probability density function. And this function has to obey the rules that it's always non-negative, and that if you integrate the function over your entire set of outcomes, then it integrates to 1. Okay. So again, we're defining, exactly a density, so that if we have some subset of our space, we can integrate over that subset and get a probability assignment for that specific subset. Okay. Now, we're going to confine ourselves to subsets of our Borel field. So, you know, again, that was the field constructed by taking half measures. Okay, so from minus infinity to up to a point. Okay. So we call that function the probability density function, and again, it's like a density in the sense that if you then look over any interval and integrate over any interval, you get the actual probability for that interval. Okay, so let's look at some examples. We have a unit, you know, one of the easiest ones would be the uniform. So we say that, you know, we want to say that something's equally likely between A and B. Then, again, the integral from A to B is B minus A, so the length, the length of this interval. And so if it's equally likely over all points, you'd think 1 over the length of that interval. And so, again, if you integrate sort of any interval within that, again, you're going to get the likelihood of being in that interval. Exponential distribution. Cover later. This one's quite handy within queues and is used to specify inter-arrival times. Gaussian distribution, that gives you your normal curve. Okay. So the main point about all these is, well, again, we have some physical interpretation. And then, again, they obey our rules. They're non-zero, or it's not non, they're non-negative. And if you integrate over sigma, then you're going to get to 1. Okay, so they in some way satisfy our basic requirements for assigning probabilities. Again, what they do is they give you, instead of having to write out for every set, just write out essentially what the probability is. It allows you a functional shorthand. Okay, so again, they have to satisfy that probability of integrating to 1. And so if we look at sort of, again, a concrete example for our exponential function, well, e to the minus 2r is always positive, so that's always positive. And then we need to integrate it over the entire range, so from 0 to infinity. And again, if you do that, you'll see that it integrates to 1. We can, again, calculate the probability of being in any interval since by, again, integrating over that interval. So the probability of being between 0 and 1, we come between 0 and 1, and we get 1 to the minus e to the minus 1 minus e to the minus 2. Okay. There we go. So, we're almost finished. We now have a way of assigning, a functional way of assigning probabilities that has brought us from set functions to functions on either the integers or the real number line. Okay. The final thing we'll consider is mapping events to numerical values. And then dealing with the probabilities that that arise from that. Okay. So we sort of snuck that in with our Bernoulli trials and other distributions where we've changed, you know, again, the binary PMF, we changed from heads to zeros and tails to ones, or vice versa. So again, we now just, you know, we'll sort of put that idea on a formal setting. So suppose we're interested in something like the number of heads that turn up. Okay. And suppose we have two coin tosses. Then there's three possibilities for how many heads turn up: none, one, or two. And we refer to that mapping from sets to numerical values as a random variable. And what we need to do then, so again, this can sort of go from something, some underlying complex space into some simple numbers, but what we need to do then is think about how we're going to assign any sort of probability measure to that. So, again, if we know what the underlying mapping is, the probability, then we can construct and the probability assignments from there. Okay. So, essentially what we've done is we've defined a new probability mass function. Now, from our whatever our underlying space was onto just these numbers. Okay. We can then generate an event space based on these numbers. And define, construct the probabilities of these more complex events as well. What it turns out we've done, again, is we've defined, doing that, what we do is we define a new probability space. So the original outcomes are mapped onto numerical outcomes. The original events are mapped onto sets of numerical events or sets of numerical outcomes. And for each of these, we've defined a probability measure. Okay. In order to do that properly, we have to essentially be able to perform the mapping in both directions. So we need to be able to map our numbers then back onto the original event space and map all our sets back onto the original event space. So it's got to be a two-way mapping. Okay. And so again, if you're talking about these sort of simple countable spaces, that's fairly straightforward. We can do the same thing for continuous random variables, so we can map our original space onto the real line. And in this case, we can define a probability space that consists of the real line, the Borel field on that, and then, you know, again, the mapped probability measure. Okay. And so, again, the probability measure of the real-valued random variable has to be derived from the probability measure in the original space. Okay. And again, we're assigning it to members of the Borel field, so not to specific points, but to intervals. Okay. And so this idea leads us to our final definition, which is of the cumulative distribution function. And so we have this idea that we're trying to assign probabilities to these half intervals. Okay. And the interpretation of this is that the probability of our random variable is less than some point that we pick, x. And so, obviously, once you've defined your half intervals, you can define and you can find any other sort of interval by, again, essentially subtracting off the intersection. Okay. So. That means that for these random variables, we have essentially two different ways of expressing probability. We can express it as the cumulative distribution function, which is given by the probability of being in a half interval, or as before, we can think of finding it using our probability density function. Okay. And so we have a relation between the two, in that the probability density function gives us the probability of the half interval being the integral from minus infinity to infinity of the probability density function. But this is the same as the cumulative distribution function. Okay. And so, one way of thinking of it is if you have your PDF, as you move, if you keep extending your interval, again, from minus infinity to some point alpha, as you increase alpha, you're sort of picking up likelihood according to the density function. Okay. And so as you go to infinity, you're collecting all of the possibilities. Your CDF is directly assigning values to that. So again, it's the integral of the PDF. Okay. And so the final, just point to make about CDFs versus PDFs is that given a CDF, it may or may not be sort of that easy to find the PDF, okay? So, for instance, for your normal, and vice versa. So, again, it's fairly abstract, and so we're going from sort of a very general idea of probability spaces and what underlies them to something numerical that, again, we can manipulate. So sort of as we move on, we'll just sort of take the idea of random variables as a given, and we will be just writing down directly either the CDF or the PDF for them, and we won't be worrying about the fact that they have this underlying structure of a Borel field, etc. So that's that for today. What we'll do next time is, again, move this theory on to look at things that are sort of, again, continuous with time and sort of changing with time, and see how we can get a handle on that extra dimension. So we'll leave it for today. Have a good weekend, and I'll see you guys next week.